Today is February 15th. It's approximately 1:40. With us today, we have Representative Moses, Representative Holmes, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Co-Chair, Representative Chenault, Vice Chair, Representative Stoltz, Representative Hawker is excused, Representative Weirock is here, and Representative Croft. I don't see Representative Jewell just yet. Okay, so before us, we have Senate Bill 62 is the first item we'll be taking up. And if this bill looks similar to a bill we've already heard, it is the same as House Bill 79. So, but we do have with us today the Lieutenant Governor, who is going to briefly present Senate Bill 62 to us and offer any comments, and then be available for questions. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, I want to welcome the Lieutenant Governor Lehman to the table. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, if it's okay with you, I've asked the Director of the Division of Elections to also be here to talk about some of the details of some of the parts of it to deal with the Division of Elections. I would, however, like to offer some overarching comments about the request for supplemental funds. And let me just say at the outset that I never liked supplemental requests when I was in the legislature. I even blame you if you feel the same way as I have, and I don't really like to make a supplemental request today. However, there are times when conditions change, and not all of the reasons for a supplemental request can be associated with failure. In fact, this last election cycle, we saw some spectacular successes with the election that resulted in additional costs. For example, we set a new record when it came to voter turnout. 25,000 more voters than our previous high year. We had twice as many people request absentee ballots as had ever requested ballots before. We had something like twice as many people voted by fax. The number of special advance ballots, I believe it was something like seven times the number before. And all of these things, if you, like me, believe it's a good thing for people, for voters to participate in our electoral process, then I think we have to look at that as being a success. Along the way, there were missteps and things that caused the cost to go up. One of these was the court ruling that resulted in a reprinting of the ballots, and there were costs associated with that. I have some very deeply held feelings, beliefs on my conduct, and so does one of the sponsors who is here sitting at this table. I think rather than us go toe-to-toe here today on that, which we did in court during the fall, actually he and I didn't, but his very well-paid and high-priced attorney and our Department of Law did that. I think most of us know what some of those results were. But rather than do that, I think it's fair to say I disagree with some of his basic precepts, and I disagree with all due respect to our judiciary that the summary written was inaccurate. I believe to this day that it was accurate, and I also disagree that it was biased, and those are two things that Judge Kristen found. But we, rather than appealing further and further jeopardizing the ability to distribute absentee ballots to voters around the world, many of which are serving our country in the military, believe that it would be a far more prudent thing to do to distribute, to reprint and distribute those ballots. So the bottom line is no, I believe that it shouldn't have happened. I wish it hadn't. And, everyone can start right from the beginning on things like, I consider it to be an affront to this body, because you passed legislation last year that we determined was substantially similar, and the issue shouldn't even have been on the ballot at all. But the court, the Alaska Supreme Court, decided otherwise, issued a decision and said, opinion to follow. Well, Mr. Chairman, we're still waiting for that opinion. And that was the end of August. We had 3 days on the basis of that decision to write ballot language that said what it would do and get the ballots distributed 60 days before the election to meet our requirements under the law. We did the best we could in interacting with the Department of Law and writing what we believed was fair. That wasn't until some 3 weeks later that we were challenged and openly challenged in court. So there's I tell that story, and I think that I'll probably leave it at that, just to say that you have before you a request for supplemental funds to help the division operate. I believe that the Division of Elections itself conducted itself this year admirably in responding to a number of crises, whether it was an onslaught of absentee ballot requests, tremendous onslaught, and many of them came in batches near the end and had to make temporary hires to respond to this. But they did a good job responding to it, and this supplemental request will help recover those costs and will enable the division to keep functioning. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude my remarks and will let the division director continue, and of course we'll be happy to respond to your questions.
Okay, thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Any questions for the Lieutenant Governor before we turn the floor over to Ms. Glazier? Seeing none, thank you for joining us today and for your testimony. Ms. Glazier, did you want to add anything else? Or?
For the record, Laura Glazier, Director of Division of Elections. Mr. Chairman, as the committee knows, we went through, this is identical to House Bill 79, which we discussed previously. The language is the same. The requests and the unanticipated and excessive costs were all discussed in House Bill 79. If you have specific questions or would like to deal with that, or if you would like me to walk back through that, I would be happy to do that for you too.
What's the wish of the committee? Do we need to go through the expenses again? Okay. I see a lot of heads being shook. What is the time constraint on this, Ms. Glazier?
Mr. Chairman, I was notified last week that we're in the red right now.
You're in the red? Okay. That means you're in a hurry.
We're broke.
It means she's in a red state.
Okay. Okay.
You're not supposed to know.
All right. Well, seeing no questions. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and Ms. Glazier. Ms. Glazier, you may want to stay around if there's any amendments to be introduced and spoken to. Okay. So at this time, do we have any amendments to make to Senate Bill Number 62? I see one has been introduced. Representative Croft.
I'll move amendment number one.
Okay, I'll object for purposes of discussion.
And appreciated the Lieutenant Governor's remarks. It's not my intent to rehash the entire set of litigation that went on over the ballot language on on any specific initiative, but particularly the initiative Trust the People. What I do think is important for this committee to say, and the reason I put this amendment on, is the power to write language on the ballot is one that we need to be very careful with. And I wanted to put the Division of Elections and the Lieutenant Governor on notice. I mean, the sanctity of that ballot and the power that government has to influence by changing the language is something that we need to be very careful with and should not use to influence, but rather to inform. It's an obligation, because the fight's over what it means or what it should do, and influencing should take place away from the ballot. That's not what the court found happened here. We don't have to agree on that court ruling, to all agree that this is something that should be taken very seriously, and I think we should do, state our intent to the Lieutenant Governor's Office and the Division of Elections, that we want them to be careful, and we're going to look, we're going to pay this. I'm not even asking that the $240,000 that it cost be taken out of their budget or denied them, but I am hoping we will say, you have to treat this very seriously, and we will look very carefully if you come again because of costs for ballot language that has been found to be biased or inaccurate, that it's a serious issue to us, and that you better be on notice that that we may not next time. I disagree with obviously a lot of the factual assertions that the Lieutenant Governor made. In particular, we had a lot of time to work together on ballot language as the litigation was going. It wasn't, you didn't have just 3 days. It would have been prudent to be working on the language as the case progressed, and many other of the statements. But I don't think we need to do that here. I do think it's appropriate for us to say, in a thing that is as important as ballot language, as costly as $250,000, that we intend the Division of Elections to very carefully follow the law, and we'll look very carefully if they come back with more supplementals because of inaccurate or biased language on the ballot.
Okay, thank you, Representative Crofts. Any other discussion on Amendment 1? Okay. Go ahead, Representative
Robert. Maybe it's through the chair to Representative Crock. Are you going to poll this amendment now that you've discussed it? Because it's really not germane to the appropriation.
I think
if you want to do it on elections bill, this is completely irrelevant to an appropriation, supplemental appropriation. It seems to me.
Go ahead, Representative Crock.
It's perfectly germane to the bill. $243,000 of this supplemental appropriation is costs incurred for having inaccurate and biased language on the ballot. We are paying in this supplemental for this happening in the past, and it's the exact appropriate time to say we don't intend to do it in the future. It's the place we often put in appropriations in the budget, intent language telling the departments what we expect them to do with the money or what we expect them not to do in the future. The operating budget has that kind of language all over it. And in this appropriate, it's perfectly appropriate as you give a supplemental to say, but we don't want this kind of thing to happen again.
Representative Barber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Ms. Glazer being up here, right? I think you did a lot of work working overtime to get the election done and accounted for it. Did some of the money that has caused you to go into the red go into the recounts that were requested after the general election?
Representative Wyrock, through the chair, yes, sir, they did, as well as personnel costs. There were several costs related to the management of the Division of Elections that were excessive costs and unanticipated costs. However, the ballot language the division has does not draft it, nor do we have control over the submission of the language to us.
Right. Was the work and the extra work that you did after the general election and doing the recounts and going into the red because of that related to any court decision?
Representative Wyrock, through the chair, no, sir, it was not.
And was it anything that the Lieutenant Governor did?
Representative Wyrock, for the chair, no, it was not. It was driven one by a candidate and one by a group of citizens.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wyrock. Yes, and we did discuss this quite a bit of detail on under House Bill 79 when that was before us. And again, I'll reiterate my comments. I think you did an outstanding job pulling off the election, and your people worked extremely hard. Obviously, everybody that's here likes the outcome of your work. So, my hats off to you and your group for pulling off a great election. I'm going to personally be opposed to Amendment Number 1. There's no other discussion. Go ahead, Russell.
I should probably keep quiet more often, just the timeline. Did you feel that you had grounds to appeal that perhaps didn't because of the trying to protect the integrity of the election process in a timely manner? I just want to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoltz, whenever we're in court, you have to make judgment calls on the investment. Obviously, it takes time, it costs money. And in this particular case, we had to pass judgment on, is the risk worth it? And is it worth risking the votes of Alaskans who are abroad by further stalling this and not inviting them to participate? That was one thing that invented. The other is, every time you look at an appeal, you have to decide what are your chances of succeeding on appeal. And so you go through an analysis of that. And ultimately our conclusion was, and it was supported or is concurred by the Attorney General, that we would not appeal. I don't like the additional costs. I don't believe that we should have been there in the first place. And I take my job as Lieutenant Governor very seriously in writing ballot language. And I can assure you that I'm not cavalier about how I go about it. And in fact, this is done very deliberatively with the Department of Law, as well as proponents and opponents of initiatives. See, the thing we have to recognize is that I can't write language that somebody wants just because they're a proponent or an opponent of an initiative. I have to fall somewhere in between, and eventually it's possible that nobody likes it because I don't advance it as much. In this case, Representative Croft didn't like it. It didn't advance his cause as much as he would like. But there were opponents to it who likewise were pulling the other way. I believe that the language as written was accurate, and I certainly can demonstrate that information as to why it's accurate. And this election we just went through demonstrated it. It took a month or slightly more than a month, I think, if I'm correct, to certify the election. And that normally is going to be the process. And so that is information that I believe is important to place before the voter. The voter can then make a judgment in terms of if that's a good thing or if it's not.
No, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. I could probably make some amendments, the amendments on judicial activism and some of my subjective views, but I know Mr. Wolliver from the court system is savoring his relative anonymity on this bill, and so I wouldn't want to drag Doug up here. So, thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor.
Mr. Chairman, there's one other comment on this, and I probably should follow my own advice, which is, if you have the votes, you vote, and if you don't, you talk, and I would anticipate that in this case I shouldn't talk, but within the language I find it interesting that Mr. Croft has said, and point number three, is that it forced the Division of Elections to reprint thousands of ballots with the, and listen to this, proper impartial summary of the proposed law. Well, that is not what his counsel argued at the end. They did not accept the language that was the final language that was printed. And now he's saying it's proper and impartial. And his counsel argued at the end, and the judge rejected that argument and accepted what we and the Department of Law prepared as about language. And so I find this interesting that he's come around to concluding even that was proper and impartial when we had a lot of effort went through demonstrating why that was indeed a fair language.
You're correct, Lieutenant Governor. I think you have the votes. So let's continue on here. No other comments, Madam Clerk. Please read the roll. I'll maintain my objection to amendment number one.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Jewell?
Pass.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Schultz?
No.
Representative Weirach?
No.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Hawker?
No.
Representative Meyer?
No.
Representative Chenault?
No.
And Representative Chu?
No.
Okay. Two in favor?
Go ahead. Two, nine.
Nine against.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Madam Clerk. Amendment fails. Any other amendments to come to force? Hate to lose an appropriations bill, but I know you're in a hurry, so Representative Foster.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out HB 62, or SB 62, out of House Finance with individual recommendations.
Any objection? Seeing none, bill passes. Here, thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Okay, let's just take a brief recess here as we change presenters and take up the next bill, which is Senate Bill 56, Criminal Law Procedures. So just if the next group wants to come on up. Criminal Law Procedures and Sentencing. The intent on this bill today is to take all the comments from the sponsor and other interested parties and any public comments, certainly have discussion on the bill. Then I would like to hold the bill over until tomorrow, so if anybody does have any amendments, try to get the amendments to us tonight or the committee members tonight so they have a chance to look at them before we take this back up tomorrow. So, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Senator Terrio. Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. And thank you for scheduling the bill in a timely fashion. The United States Supreme Court ruling in June 2004 in the case of Blakely versus the state of Washington struck down Washington's sentencing law, finding the Sixth Amendment gives defendants the right to have a jury, not a judge, determine whether aggravating circumstances exist to justify increasing a defendant's sentence above the statutory prescribed term. The requirements of Hawaii Clean directly affect Alaska's sentencing law as a result of having created confusion in our courts. I'd like to just now go over, and therefore, the two bills, the Senate bill that is before you today and the House bill that Representative Samuels introduced, were put into the system to correct this the confusion that's been caused by the court decision. I'd like to walk just briefly through sort of some bullet points here to talk about what is included in the bill. It is a fairly lengthy piece of legislation due to the way the drafting brings in sections, makes minor changes. It's a little bit longer than you would think, but that's, of course, the way our drafting works. Then, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to go downstairs and make a quorum of another committee. Representative Samuels is here, certainly. I work closely with he and his staff, and both of us have worked with members of the Department of Law, from the Department of Law, with the representatives from the judiciary, and I know that those representatives are here to answer questions. The bill amends current presumptive sentencing of felony offenders from a set term to a range of terms to bring Alaska's law into conformity with the recent court decision. The bill also requires that aggravators be taken to a jury for an upward departure of the sentence above the range. So instead of having a set number of years that is the presumptive 5 years, it gives a range of 5 to 7 years. If the judge wants to go beyond that range of 7 years, then they would have to get a finding of facts from the jury in order to go beyond that range. It provides clarification that aggravating factor of a crime do not have to be presented to the grand jury. Again, if you want to go beyond that suggested range of 5 to 7, you would not have to have thought of that right at the very beginning when you're taking the going to the grand jury to see if there's even enough evidence to charge the person with a crime. You would not have to allege and take those potential aggravators to the grand jury at that time. The bill allows for more discretion of judges to impose probation. It limits frivolous appeals of sentences that fall within the legislative mandated ranges, but allows for a petition for review that would be made to the Court of Appeals. And right now, the right for a petition or an appeal to the Court of Appeals for substantive matters would be also preserved. Other provisions of the bill, it allows for an additional aggravator in sentencing when a defendant has a prior criminal convictions of 5 or more Class A misdemeanors. An amendment that was adopted in the House Judiciary, which is currently in the version of the bill that's before you, allows for a sentence to be mitigated if a judge finds that a defendant suffers from a mental disorder or disability, including fetal alcohol spectrum. This excludes crimes against a person and crimes of arson. Additionally, the bill has been amended to limit the ability of judges to order periodic sentences in which the offender periodically leaves prison and then returns to prison, amounting to what it is, unsupervised release of the defenders. And the way the language is in the bill right now, it allows the correctional facilities to better manage the prison population and better supervise the offenders. And the changes allows for periodic sentencing, or periodic release from prison, only if the sentence was 2 years and the employment obligation, if it's linked to an employment obligation that pre-existed the original sentence. And finally, the bill improves public safety by stipulating the authority of police officers to detain or arrest offenders for violating probation and parole conditions, and allows the parole board to deny further consideration for discretionary probation parole when it has already been found that the offender is not a candidate for parole. So those are the major provisions of the legislation. As I indicated, there are representatives here from the Department of Law that we've worked closely with. Representative Samuels is here as the co-sponsor in the House, or the prime sponsor in the House version of the bill. And you also have a representative here from the court system to answer questions, too. So, Mr. Chairman, I am available if there are any questions right now for me. I'll answer them as best I can.
Okay, thank you, Senator Terrio. Senator Terrio, this sounds like a pretty heavy judiciary bill, and we're in finance here, so I'm going to just ask. The fiscal impact then is just the one fiscal note for $131,000. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And that.
And several indeterminates.
That fiscal note. Yeah. The one fiscal note from the Public Defender's Office was zeroed out on the Senate side.
Okay.
We thought that a good portion of the argument that this passage of the piece of legislation may trigger litigation on the new system. Well, that's a charge that could be leveled at any piece of legislation that passes. So we didn't figure that that was anything more than sort of cost of doing business in general. And I guess I would just ask any of you to imagine that any bill that you introduce, if somebody could sue when that new law goes onto the books, whether your bill should be dogged in by a fiscal note, because there is that potential. And that's what we saw a lot of, that indeterminate fiscal note, particularly from the Public Defender's Office.
Okay, very good. I'm assuming this had quite a bit of discussion in the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, it did. I think it was in the for upwards of a week, week and a half.
Question.
Okay, go ahead.
Senator Terrio, what would be the problem if we didn't pass this bill?
Well, the Department of Law, I think, can give you a whole host of horror stories that are going to happen with regards to the number of appeals that they're currently handling for defendants or people that are incarcerated that were convicted and given presumptive sentences. If they don't change the law and there's any kind of presumption given going forward, there's going to be appeals. So I think right now there's just a lot of uncertainty in the court system, in the correction system, with regards to how many people are going to be coming. So we like to deal with this so that we can take away that uncertainty, but certainly the representative from the Department of Law can give you probably some concrete examples of problems that we're currently facing and likely to face if we let this uncertainty continue very much longer.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Senator Terrio.
Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Samuels. Good to have you here. Anything you want to add in more to that?
I know that Senator Terrio has to leave, so I'll be here for questions. Talk to you.
Okay. Very good. Did you want to add any more to his testimony?
Through the chair, to answer Representative Weirach's question, I know the Department of Law will be able to answer it, but right now, to have an aggravator at all, you would have to right now have a separate jury trial. So the fiscal note then from law, not passing the law, is either going to have the separate trials or you're not going to be able to aggravate the sentences. And even if they are deserved of these aggravators, and there's all of these one at a time aggravators, you have to go to a separate trial. And I'm assuming that Ms. Parks will tell you that her fiscal note is now going to grow. For mitigators, Blakely didn't touch on mitigators, so the judge can still go down without a separate trial, but they cannot go up from the presumptive sentence. So we gave a range, and even if there are several aggravators, if you go above the initial range which we have set, you would you still have to go to a jury trial. But we're trying to give a little bit of leeway to not have to go to a jury trial every time that there is an aggravator, and the aggravators are listed in the bill. I'm sure the law could probably into the technical details of far better than I can.
You did a good job.
Lawyer, that's the implications of not passing the bill.
All right, you did a good job, Representative Samuels. A question, Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Samuels, so there could possibly be a positive fiscal note attached to this. Cost savings.
Through the chair, from what it used to be before Blakely to now, you would probably have a fiscal note. From where we are standing today, there should be a positive fiscal note, in my opinion. Because we're going to have the separate jury trial right now, that when the bill passes, you will not have.
Well, these will look a lot better if they have positive numbers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe you can make that change for the Representative Schnoller. Okay, thank you, Representative Samuels. Yes, we do have Susan Parks on the list here to testify, Deputy Attorney General, the Criminal Division of Law. welcome to House Finance, Ms. Parks, and if you could give us your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I am Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here to testify regarding Senate Bill 56. And if I may just address the questions that have come up most recently. The biggest problem right now is our current statutory scheme is unconstitutional. I mean, we know it is because of the Blakely decision, and so I think it's incumbent to make a change so that our statutory scheme is constitutional. There are several options on how to do that. I believe that this bill is a balanced approach to complying with Blakely, but in a way that does not increase resources to the point that you have positive fiscal notes coming along with the bill. The problems that are going on right now are very real, and I think Representative Chenault's comment about positive fiscal notes and Representative Samuel's comment is correct. I think you would hear from the Public Defender Agency, myself, the court system, the workload because of Blakely has increased enormously. Hundreds of motions, we are dealing with hundreds of motions from people who are saying that they have illegal sentences because of the Blakely decision. We're having to go back in hearings to address this. The other problem is if we don't do anything, you leave it to the trial judges to interpret Blakely, and we are already getting contradictory interpretations across the state and even from different judges within Anchorage. We've had one judge in Anchorage and one judge in Fairbanks both rule that the entire presumptive statutory scheme is unconstitutional, that by Blakely ruling that the aggravator piece is unconstitutional, you have to throw the whole scheme out. So we've got a couple of judges in the state sentencing currently with complete discretion. Of course, we're appealing those decisions, but it takes quite a while to get those, you know, decisions back from the Court of Appeals and from the Supreme Court, which is where I think it would ultimately go. So there really is a bit of chaos in the system right now, uncertainty for defendants, uncertainty for victims. These cases are going to be in limbo. Once this bill is passed, at least with every case that occurs once this bill passes, there will be some certainty about the system and that the sentences comply with the statutory scheme that the legislature has passed. Senator Terrio and Representative Samuels did a good job of describing the bill, so I won't go into a lot of detail. I'd be happy to answer, obviously, any questions that you might have. Just to put it in context, I did just want to briefly touch on why we went to a presumptive sentencing scheme to begin with. In the early, you know, 70s, the 60s, 70s, judges had wide open discretion. There were maximum sentences set for offenses, say a C felony 0 to 5, a B felony 0 to 10, and judges could simply sentence however they saw fit in the individual case. There was a study done by the Alaska Judicial Council that found that there was extreme disparity in sentences, that people were given similar, defendants for similar offenses across the state were being given wildly different sentences. So this legislature, or a prior legislature, passed a presumptive sentencing scheme, and that was sort of what was happening across the country. The federal system went to a presumptive sentencing scheme, and it appears to have been a success. The 1999 study the Alaska Judicial Council did on felony sentencing found that there were not disparities within presumptive sentencing. So it seems to be a success. So we helped craft this bill with the sponsors in a way that would preserve presumptive sentencing but allow a certain amount of discretion for the judges to impose individualized sentences without a real burden on the system, because it is a burden on the system to have to take aggravators to a separate jury trial. And so we were hoping to minimize that. And in terms of a fiscal impact, the Department of Law does have a zero fiscal note on this, because we believe that, in fact, once a system is in place, there will not be any additional costs. That although we may end up taking some cases to jury trial and aggravators, those are going to be the exceptional case. That the ranges, as said, and you should have a chart in your packets that set out the ranges that have been crafted, typically are going to give the judges enough discretion where it's going to be the very exceptional case, the extremely bad actor, that we're going to want to propose aggravators and take those to jury trial. Some aggravators are going to be apparent within the case, and so it's really not going to be a lot of additional testimony and evidence. It's going to be apparent from the facts of the case. Others will require a bifurcation. That would be where the jury, a bifurcation of the case. That's where a jury would find the defendant guilty of the underlying offense. They'd come back, we'd present evidence on aggravators, and they would then have to have a verdict on the aggravators. In terms of the ranges, there has been concern expressed in previous hearings, and I would echo the comments. This bill has gotten a lot of scrutiny in both the Senate Judiciary and the House Judiciary particularly. There were lots of amendments actually passed and lots of amendments that were considered and not passed, but one of the concerns that came up was that we're going to increase costs because we're really increasing sentences. And I think to address that, the Senate, because that is not the intent of this bill. The intent of the bill is simply to preserve the system in the best way we can while complying with Blakely. And to sort of emphasize that, the Senate Judiciary passed a letter of intent that was incorporated into the bill by the House Judiciary that clearly states that it's not the intent of this bill to overall increase sentences. And so I think that hopefully that'll be a message to the judges, and it's certainly been a message to us and to DOC that that's not what the intent is. I really don't have any other comments about the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions now or at any time. If amendments are taken up, if there's any questions about the amendments or questions about the bill as you hear additional testimony.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. We do have a question for Representative Stoltz.
Thank you. Chairman, despite the best attempts at Mr. Marquez and Parks and Representative Sanders, I'm still trying to keep up with this. As I was understanding it, if this bill passes, there'll still be a process. You would triage the most serious cases to pursue the aggravators. Is that the idea?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, that's what I anticipate happening. I believe that what prosecutors are going to do is they're going to look at the ranges that are available for a sentence, and they're going to look at what aggravators might possibly be available. They're going to look at the strength of the evidence. Under our current system that's on the books, we only had to prove aggravators by clear and convincing evidence. Now we have to look at them and decide whether we can prove them beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's going to be a new analysis. Is this just like when we decide whether we're going to file charges? Can we prove it? Is it worth the resources? Should we go forward with it? And so I think in many instances, prosecutors are going to say the range is going to be adequate. That gives us an adequate sentence to address this defendant and this offense. We won't try for these aggravators that are maybe iffy. But in the very serious cases where we have strong aggravator evidence, I think we will go forward with them.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stoltz, Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Park. We have a memorandum here from the Alaska Public Defenders Agency. Can you respond to the two comments that were made by Alinda Wilson on Section 1 being unconstitutional? And I don't know if you have a copy of this, but...
heard the chair, Representative Holm, I probably got a copy of this previously. This may be a new one. through the chair, Representative Holmes. Yes, actually, this memorandum, or one very similar to it, was circulated to the House Judiciary Committee as well, and we debated the constitutionality of these exact same provisions in House Judiciary. My reading and review of the State v. Malloy and the Donlin case that's relied on to say they're saying Section 1 is that it's that we should have to take aggravators to a grand jury. In addition to taking the underlying offense, we have to take the aggravators. I don't believe that constitutionally we're required to do that. Obviously, this is something that ultimately our Supreme Court is going to probably rule on, and unfortunately I have been wrong in the past, and it's possible I could be wrong, but I don't read the cases the same. I also, we discussed in House Judiciary what the purpose of the grand jury is, and I think if you look at the Constitution and you look at what the purpose of the grand jury is in the case law, the grand jury in Alaska was created to ensure that people were not held in jail pending trial when there wasn't evidence to support the charges. That purpose is still going to be served. We're still going to take felony cases to grand jury to decide to ensure that we have the evidence for the underlying offense. Taking aggravators isn't required to ensure that the grand jury is doing its job. I think it's also important to note that this is a U.S. Supreme Court case that's requiring aggravators go to a jury trial. Our grand jury requirement is a state constitutional requirement. It is not a U.S. Supreme Court constitutional requirement. There are many states across the United States that don't require grand juries. So I don't believe that the U.S. Constitution requires that they go to a jury. That's on Section 1. Regarding Section 26, 30, and 31, these sections deal with a fix, actually, what I think is kind of a loophole and a problem in our law. There was a case recently, the Reichel case, that came out of Homer. People may be familiar with it. It was in the paper where some police officers were in a bar down in Homer, and because it's a small place and everybody knows everybody, they recognized a gentleman in the bar and believed that he was on probation or parole for a felony DUI, so they contacted him, talked with him, contacted his parole officer. Indeed, he was on parole for felony DUI. He was not supposed to be in a bar. They arrested him at the direction of the parole officer. When they frisked him, they found cocaine on him. He was charged with that as well, convicted, and he went to trial. Well, the conviction was reversed on appeal. The Court of Appeals said that the police officers could not stop him to inquire about these parole or probation conditions because it didn't rise to public safety, because that wasn't traditionally what police officers can stop citizens about. You can't just stop someone to see, are you supposed to be in a bar? Well, what sections 26, 30, and 31 do is legislatively it creates, it gives the police officers the authority upon reasonable suspicion to be able to stop parolees or probationers that they believe are violating certain enumerated conditions like geographic restrictions, like not being in a bar, not being near a victim. So you would legislatively create their ability to stop upon reasonable suspicion and arrest on probable cause. I believe, and we had this discussion in House Judiciary, that the legislature can constitutionally do that. You could create a crime violating probation or parole conditions, and that would give police officers the authority to arrest people if they're committing a crime. If you can create that kind of a crime and create that right, I believe you can create the authority for police officers to do this. You created the Roman case that's referred to talks about the special relationship between parole officers and probation officers and the individual. I think that the legislature can create that very special relationship for police officers as well. So it's simply a different interpretation.
Thank you, Ms. Park. Just as a follow-up, I want to thank you very much. I miss judiciary because I miss your sage advice on occasion. The only thing with regards to this, there's been the comment on these three sections that somehow the relationship between a person who has not committed a crime and a person who has committed a crime and who's on parole have the same rights to search and seizure. And I appreciate your clarification there. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Holman. We do have Linda Wilson online who's going to testify later, so if you want to do a follow-up to your question, you can.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Parks. There's been an issue that's a lot politically motivated. It's the issue of the whole hate crimes proposed legislation. If we have this second tier of the of a trial and just the aggravators, wouldn't that seemingly accomplish the goals of that? You'd have almost a second trial just on the hate crimes issues, the aggravators?
Through the chair, Representative Phil, I guess I'm not sure what your question is.
I was just wandering. My mind was wandering aimlessly, and I was probably saying, but we've had this issue of hate crimes, and some folks say that the existing aggravators are sufficient. But under the scenario you've described, there'd be a second trial. You could have a second trial just on those hate crime type aggravators.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I think that's very likely to prove the aggravator. It would depend on how the judge ruled, whether the judge ruled that kind of information could come in the case in chief. I think in a lot of instances, you might find a judge ruling that it's too prejudicial. For example, if the evidence was that the defendant was a member of, you know, a hate group, that there was, you know, KKK paraphernalia found in his house during a search, it's possible a judge would not allow that in the case in chief. And that, yes, indeed, we would have to have a second bifurcated trial after there was a conviction on an underlying offense.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Water.
I was telling you about two things. One is the issue of a potentially positive fiscal note and how that would work. I mean, I don't see a positive fiscal nature of this. And second, your position, which I think is less of a position than a potential theory, that creating a statutory authority for a violation of parole or where these policemen would have acted in the scope of their authority if they had done so pursuant to statute. And most of these cases are based on constitutional analysis, and they could just wipe away from look. I mean, the statute would seem to me would be perceived as a veneer of protection, but not able to trump the constitutional protections that defendants would have. So second question first, I mean, how can the legislature create a crime when it's the constitutional basis that's always implicated as a defendant, and second, the fiscal, potential fiscal positive fiscal?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, probation officers are creation of statute. Probation and parole officers are creation of statute, and they're allowed to make unannounced searches and seizures. I mean, a lot of times, you know, one of the probation conditions is that you're subject to search it at any time at the request of your probation officer. And I guess if that can be constitutional, I guess I don't understand why the legislature can't make the public safety determination that I guess you're semi-deputizing.
I see this distinction now.
Right. Deputizing police officers to act as probation parole officers, if you will. Regarding the fiscal note, I was probably speaking a little not as circumspect. What I intended to say is from where we are right now, the workload where we are right now, once this bill passes, because we are going to have certainty, it is going to decrease our workload from where we are right now. I don't think that means you should cut public defenders.
Yeah, that's right.
Through the chair of Senator Wyrock, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, the public defender's people are working even longer hours. My people are working even longer hours. The court system is working, you know, more overtime. And this will get us back to the overburdened place we were before before Blakely.
Anything else, Representative Barber? Okay, Representative
Crock. On the points that Representative Wyrock was talking about, he got it, but I haven't yet. He's quicker than I am. On the sections 26, 30, and 31, and the Roman case, you know, what wasn't the principle of that case was that a parolee retains their constitutional rights, knowing that probation officers can come and check, search, seize at any time. But is your position then that police, that they lose their ability as a condition of parole to object to any search? I mean, can it, the very fact that they're a parolee mean that police officers can do any level of search at any, on any justification? It just, it's a constitutional sort of void?
Through the chair, Representative Croft. No, that's not what I intended, and that's not what the bill does. You still retain constitutional rights, but what the bill says is upon reasonable suspicion, police can make contact with these people. So you, there's a level there. They have to have reasonable suspicion. Certainly, we're not intending for police officers to be able to, frankly, just go hassle people they know are on probation, parole, and I think that's the concern, that you don't want them being harassed. So there has to be reasonable suspicion, and it has to be that they're violating certain enumerated conditions, and those are enumerated in the bill. And so it's not to give them the right to search at any time. That's not what the bill does.
I mean, it seems to me it's either they're either constitutionally protected or they're not. And if they are, then it's a matter of constitutional law that we can't define away. Sort of going to Representative Wyrock's formulation of it, could we do something less than reasonable suspicion? I mean, if we have the power here,
seeing this very well, it seems to me that the Roman case stands for the proposition that they only gave up a certain category of their rights, the right to not be searched by probation officers. And that they tied it to police can do this if they're acting in a probationary capacity. That is, probation officer says, well, you go to Joe's house and look. That even the Roman case understood that. This opens up a sort of whole new area of police searches and seizures of probation officers, just of parolees, just by their very status. I mean, aren't we running into Representative Wyrock's problem? You guys have conditioned it, but it's either they're either protected constitutionally or they're not. And if they are, what basis do we have to make this change?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, everyone is protected by the Constitution, and police officers don't have the right to stop anybody without reasonable suspicion. And usually it's reasonable suspicion of a crime. So I think what Roman was doing was just recognizing that constitutional right that everybody has. And I think that the legislature, though, can basically carve out a relationship for police officers with probationers and parolees on reasonable suspicion for certain violation of conditions. That wouldn't apply to other people. I mean, usually you have to have reasonable suspicion of committing a crime because most of us aren't on probation and parole. And so without anything in statute that gives police the authority to stop on reasonable suspicion of something less than a crime, like violating geographic limitations, being near the victim, in contact with the victim, there isn't any authority anywhere to allow them to even contact someone.
The police officers generally have the ability to stop on probable cause, of course, but on reasonable suspicion of any crime or just violent crimes, dangerous crimes?
Through the chair, I believe they can make contact with someone upon reasonable suspicion of
anything.
The crime.
Okay. And on the Section 1 question that Representative Holm had, the Linda Wilson cites in her brief the proposition that every fact which is legally essential to punishment must be charged in the indictment and proved by the jury. You just disagree with that assertion. It doesn't have to be charged in the indictment.
Through the chair, Representative Kropp, I do disagree. I disagree. I think you have to look at it in context of the case. And in fact, many states don't indict people because they don't go to grand jury. So the case that is being the case that's being cited had an indictment. I don't believe that that means it's constitutionally required to go to grand jury.
And the issue on appeal we're going to take up when we take up amendments, because there's a fix to it. There's a section on how these get appealed. You want to do that later?
Yeah, we'll do that tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Weiberg.
I just thought that my vision of, or my thought about parolees and those folks on probation is that they have given up constitutional rights because they've committed a crime, and until they've shown their ability to live within the confines of the law, they are subject to certain, or they're devoid of certain constitutional protections that everyone else has. And I always think of the person who goes to West Point. I was with a guy at West Point. If they see another person in the military, they can be stopped in the airport and checked for their shoes. And, you know, just because they're in the military academy. And if somebody who's on probation or parole, I mean, if the terms of their condition of their release is they're not to be in a bar drinking and they're seen in a bar, then sorry, buddy, your ticket's pink. And, and society, through the judiciary, said that's in the best interest of society. We restrict those liberties of individuals because they haven't shown ability to live in the confines of the law initially. And that's the price they pay. You agree?
Through the chair, I do agree with that. I agree with everything you said.
Does law agree?
Department of Law?
No, law, judge, the equal justice under law, the court.
Through the chair, Representative, I think so. I mean, I think I can tell you that that case, when it was in the paper, of any case, generated a lot of comment from me, from people who just common sense said, what? Police officers can't stop these people? I think the public expects us to try to fix this. And so I think the law should support it. Again,
And partly doesn't it have a beneficial impact to society, even with the dilution of those constitutional rights, because we don't have to house them. We don't have to incur the state expense. So in lieu of a state expense, the state has vested the authorities to arrest them if they run afoul, to reincarcerate if they've shown a violation. And that has some societal benefits as well.
Through the chair, Representative Weirach, absolutely, and particularly, I mean, in talking with corrections, it's particularly important given our state and the geography. We have a lot of communities where there simply aren't probation or parole officers, and really the only people around to enforce these things are local law enforcement.
And one final question.
Sure.
There just needs to be a way to get rid of expunge the sentence once they have lived a good life eventually, which we don't have in the state. Would you agree with that?
Representative Weirach, to the chair, I would agree we don't have a mechanism.
He said that was such a straight case. Okay, thank you for your questions, Representative Weirach. Thank you, Ms. Parks, for your testimony. I see no other questions. Thank you again. Portia, still with us, Portia? Portia Parker, Deputy Commissioner of Corrections, and you're going to talk a little bit more about the fiscal, I understand. And so for the record, if you could give us your name and affiliation, please.
For the record, Portia Parker, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, and the content of the bill has been pretty well gone through within the sections that affect the Department of Corrections, so I'm just available if there are questions on the bills that may affect, or the sections that may affect corrections or probation, parole, or on the fiscal note.
Okay, very good. Ms. Parker, any questions? I'm going to get by. Representative Hunt's going to give you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just curious as to why at the bottom of your fiscal note, you didn't make it an indeterminate fiscal note rather than a zero fiscal note. Because you kind of alluded to it that there was going to be some costs, but you don't have any idea what the costs are, and I...
She doesn't work for the public.
I don't know what that means. Does it mean it's a decrement, or is it going to be an increase, a positive? What do you think is going to happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hall, it is a zero fiscal note for the first 6 years. We can anticipate that the changes that are proposed in the ranges for the actual change from the presumptives in the very lower range, the first felony C, sex felony C, felony B, and sex felony B, are generally the sentences are falling within the ranges that are set in the bill. So we don't anticipate any significant change in the length of sentences. They're falling about within that range already under current law with those that are established in the bill here. And I think at the end what we're saying is we have looked at how things are happening now and trying to predict what judges may or may not do and where they will go in the range and what they may do years out or how the longer sentences in the bills may affect sentences. We cannot predict what that may be in the future or what the impact may be on corrections. So at the end, basically, we do not know, and we would be guessing in any way what judges may do with this or with the current presumptive, because right now the judges can go all the way up. The maximums are the same. So a judge can go all the way up from 0 to 5 years for a first felony, C felony. And they can do that right now, and they will be able to do it after this bill, if it becomes law, goes into effect. Depending, it just changes the process for how they might get there.
But they still have 1 foot. You still have 1 foot in boiling water, and 1 in frozen water, and so you're on average, you're going to be the same. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. The sentences are
falling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's fine.
Within the range.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, thank you, Ms. Parker, for your testimony. Okay, we have Doug Wolver with the Alaska Court System. Next. And then on teleconference, we'll go to Linda Wilson, public defender. Doug, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Wolver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska Court System. As most of you know, the court typically doesn't take a position on the merits of legislation. We don't in this case either. The Blakely decision was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court. It will require a change in our sentencing law, but the court will leave it up to you to decide how best to address that problem. I do, however, have some concerns about Section 7. Now, I know that the sponsors have come up with an amendment that will be forwarded tomorrow that will fix what we see as a problem with Section 7. We'll make our fiscal note disappear. However, if you'd like, I can go over why I think the current version is a problem for us. If you'd rather I wait till tomorrow, I can do that as well.
Can you come back tomorrow? I think that would be better, and that way we can address the amendment, and okay. We can make the comparison if that's all. But thanks for the heads up. Any questions for Wilbur? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow. Okay, we'll go teleconference now to Linda Wilson, Deputy Director, Public Defender Agency. Are you with us, Ms. Wilson?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Let's see. We need to turn you up a little bit, I think. Okay, go ahead.
Is that better?
No, still can't.
Is that better?
Try it again. A little bit. Loud.
All right, how's that?
Okay, that's good.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Linda Wilson, Deputy Director of the Public Defender Agency. Thank you very much for allowing me an opportunity. I know that Finance Committee wants to stick to finance issues. I'm certainly available to answer any questions you have on our fiscal note. We do certainly stand by our indeterminate fiscal note. This bill will have a fiscal impact on our operations. If you'll look at the very first section of the bill, it talks about legislative intent. While the intent of the bill may not be to increase active imprisonment, it is certainly going to increase probationary sentences. The ranges imposed what before was a specific term of a sentence is now going to be a range. And those ranges are quite broad. So what was before a five-year presumptive is now a range of 5 to 8. What before may have been a 30-year presumptive is now a 30 to 40-year range. Most of the ranges are somewhere between 3, 5 years, 10 years. So they're big ranges. Even if you were to take the best-case scenario with these ranges and assume that the sentences aren't going to increase across the board, which I think is a tenuous assumption, there will be a lot more probationary sentences above the lower end of the range. So judges are going to be imposing probationary time. Anytime you have cases that are going to include probationary time, which currently do not, you are going to see more probation revocations. And we, of course, represent the bulk of people charged with offenses, and we also represent people charged with violations of probation. So we're going to see an increase in caseload when you, across the board, increase sentences and, at the very least, impose probationary sentences that before did not occur. So before, where you may have had somebody getting a presumptive term, there were no aggravators or mitigators involved, they would get a specific term of 5 years. Now they can get 5 to 8 years, so you could easily see a sentence of 8 with 2 suspended, 6 to serve, 2 years of probation. It is that scenario that's going to be quite likely and expected that's going to have a fiscal impact on us. We are not guessing that there is going to be protracted litigation. The merits of the state's argument that the right to an indictment, we respectfully disagree. We draw our strength from our Constitution, I think from language in the Blakely decision, from language from our U.S. Supreme, our Alaska Supreme Court in State v. Malloy, and an old case in Donlin, that this is going to get litigated. There is going to be litigation if this bill is enacted in its present form, if Section 1 stays in it. Also, there will be challenges. There is a part of the bill that we haven't really discussed, and that is Section, page 17 of the bill, Section 21, and that lists 8 aggravators that under this bill will be proved by clear and convincing evidence. So of the 31 aggravators there are, 23 would need to go to a jury. As Park said, that will be a rare case, because why would they need to go prove an aggravator when they can, in many circumstances, go to the max on a presumptive range without proving any aggravators? So it will be a rare case that where the state would go propose an aggravator that would need to be proved to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. But these 8 aggravators that are listed in here can still be proved by clear and convincing evidence to a judge. There's going to be a lot of question about those 8 aggravators and whether or not those should be proved to a jury or not, and whether keeping them in front of a judge by clear and convincing evidence complies with Blakely. In addition, we have the challenges that are going to occur from Sections 26, 30, and 31. I think, again, we respectfully disagree. Our Constitution provides for a right against unreasonable searches and seizures. We have a right to privacy. We have the Roman case. I think this is going to be litigated. For those reasons, and in addition, I think we are going to see more cases go to trial. With uncertainty in the ranges, there are many cases there might pre-Blakely have resolved with an open sentencing. Now when you've got a range, there's less certainty. Those cases may not, actually those cases will not get resolved, and so there will be more jury trials. If you were to look at Blakely, because there's been some discussion about, well, right now the world we're operating under right now, post-Blakely, before any fix is made by the legislature to our current statutory scheme, you also need to look at, so our fiscal note is based on where we were before Blakely. So we have pre-Blakely cases, we have post-Blakely cases, and then we're going to have the world we're going to live in if this bill passes. what happens with the cases that are impacted post likely until a decision is, you know, legislation is enacted? Our fiscal note doesn't address that. And Ms. Parks is absolutely correct. We've been overwhelmed because of this uncertainty. But pre-Blakely, pre-Apprendi, that's where we're coming from. So if that gives perspective to the fiscal note, because I think that's what we're addressing in this bill. So I don't have any other comments. I'm certainly available to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wilson. I don't think Representative Croft has a question.
A couple of you were referring, is that the Cheney factors, the eight that don't need to be proved by beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury?
No. There was language in Blakely that said except for prior convictions, those can be proved by, you know, to a judge by clear and convincing evidence. Those were not, that was sort of an exception in the Blakely case. These aggravators, C7, 8, 12, 15, 19, 20, 21, and 31, and you can actually look at those aggravators specifically on pages
12 and 13.
Yes, 12, 13. Some of them involve the fact of a prior conviction, but there are also additional facts that have to be proved within those aggravators. Whether or not those additional facts need to be proved to a jury is the question, and that will get litigated. So, for example, in aggravator number 8, the defendant's prior criminal history includes conduct involving aggravated or repeated instances. So whether that prior history includes aggravated or repeated instances of assaultive behavior are additional facts beyond the mere fact of a conviction. They're in seven. If it was a more serious class of offense, that's an additional fact. So there is going to be some disagreement about whether these targeted eight should fit under simply a prior conviction. I mean, some of them are very simple, like I believe it's number 15. The defendant has three or more prior felony convictions. Very simple. That can be proved, clear and convincing evidence to a judge. There are no additional facts in there.
Yeah, I guess I finally got it in my head as there are sort of three different types of aggravating factors. The Blakely factual ones that have to be proven under the Blakely case to a jury beyond reasonable doubt. The Cheney factors there elsewhere. And the ones you're talking about here that are sort of judicial notice factors that we're putting them in the category that they're not really factual, they're part of the record. And you're saying that in some of them there are facts underlying them?
Or in addition to them.
Right.
Correct.
On the on your memorandum on the idea, how do you counter the idea that Ms. Parks talked about, which is you and Representative Weirach to some extent, that you do lose some of your constitutional rights as a parolee as a consequence of committing the crime, and then in particular we can set conditions of parole, which is always where I put that ability for probation officers to search any time. In effect, we gave them the choice, do you want to stay at jail or do you want to be paroled? And if you want to be paroled, you understand that here are the things that can happen. What if you can condition it that way and say, you understand the only way we're going to let you out is if you agree that a probation officer can search you any time, why can't we put this police officer search in that same sort of waiver category?
Well, and that's an interesting question, and thank you for asking me. A person on probation or parole, first of all, let me clarify, a person who is released on mandatory parole is not given a choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's you can choose to not go on probation. You cannot choose not to go on parole.
Well, yeah.
So those conditions, you don't choose that. even though you may be having a lesser right in terms of the relationship with your probation officer, in Roman, they specifically said, you know, okay, that may apply to your probation or parole officer for reasonably conducted searches, or police officer acting under their direction. But conditions of probation are not necessarily crimes. And so if you look at page 19, some of the conditions, they're not inherently dangerous. They don't threaten serious harm to persons or property. They may be, you know, ones that would help a person improve and behave, but if you look at some of those conditions on page 19, geographic limitations, being in a place where alcoholic beverages are sold or served, or operating or driving a motor vehicle, some of those things are not crimes. They're not inherently dangerous in and of themselves. So you still need to protect citizens, even people who are on probation or parole, from unreasonable searches and seizures. And characterizing this as simply police contacts, I think, is an understatement. This bill talks about detaining, arresting. We're not talking about a simple contact. We're talking about seizing somebody based upon a reasonable suspicion. So the police officer gets to detain them based upon just their reasonable suspicion, either that they're even on probation, that they may have violated a condition of probation, that may not be a crime in and of itself, or may not even be dangerous or harmful to public in and of itself. So you're certainly, I think, running into some serious constitutional troubles with that. And again, you know, we did discuss this a lot in judiciary. We respectfully disagree.
I'm sorry. It is sort of a key area, so I appreciate the time. Could I define the crime of violating your probation or parole conditions and sort of bootstrap it that way?
Well, I think you could do it by requiring, even down on page 19, changing the or to and. It seems like if the conduct creates imminent public danger or threatens serious harm to persons or property in addition to violating it, that seems to make more sense to me. But when it doesn't create those things, it's not a crime in and of itself. You don't have you haven't checked with the PO, the probation or parole officer. I think to stand muster, it would certainly improve this bill.
Some parole violations are not inherently dangerous, and some are. You know, a person in a bar who had agreed as a condition not to be there may or may not be a, you know, a sex offender on a school grounds is. There are some parole violations that are inherently dangerous, right?
Well, I think that's a call for the probation officer to make.
Not the police officer.
Not the police officer.
And finally, on that section one.
Okay.
Why is it so important? I mean, as long as the jury finds the factor by beyond a reasonable doubt, what purpose does it serve? And by them finding it, you're going to, as a necessity, have notice by the defendant. You know, you're going to know that that's being proved. It's got to be told to the jury, and you'll have your chance to respond. Why is it so important to have it mentioned in the indictment, given that it's going to have to be mentioned in the trial to be proved to the jury?
Well, I through the chair, Representative Croft, we have a right to a grand jury in our Constitution. I think the whole problem with what happened and why Blakely came out the way it did was because what was happening is aggravators really became elements. Aggravators were sort of reclassifying elements as sentencing factors. And so if you have something that is essential to the punishment, it needs to be charged in the indictment. This then gives fair warning and notice, but it also, it's because that grand jury should be deciding whether or not they meet all the elements of the offense. and they should know what the elements are that expose this person to that punishment. And I think that was the basis. And you know, they mentioned numerous times in Blakely, must be charged in the indictment, where a defendant has no warning in either his indictment or plea that this is what they're facing. And certainly in our Alaska Supreme Court case, State v. Valois, they refer to that same language. So,
I understand why Blakely would emphasize it as part of its point that you need to prove it to the jury. But once you're proving it to the jury, I'm not sure why then you need the indictment. If you had neither the notice from the indictment or the obligation to prove it to a jury, that created the situation that led to the decision that was unconstitutional. But having clarified the right to have it proved to a jury, I guess I'm still trying to figure out what the addition of the indictment gets you. But I'll think about it. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Croft. Representative Stoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was kind of confused by that idea that a police officer couldn't perform a probation. Just a hypothetical, if there was a serial rapist who committed all of his offenses under the influence of alcohol in my district, and the police officer that arrested him several years before saw his car at the local bar, I don't understand the public policy interest in not letting that person, that police officer who knew the behavior and the things that led to his behavior. I don't understand some of the things that come out of the public defender's office, but this one is just confusing the heck out of me. And that why, you know, I know a lot of cops. Why the cop I know couldn't inform? Well, I know that guy. He was he committed some grievous acts, and he was under the influence of alcohol. And there he is at the neighborhood bar, and that's one of the conditions of his parole, because police officers that do their job follow the case. They take a real interest in the perpetrators. They work pretty hard, and they're always grousing to me about, we arrest these people, and those blankety-blank judges and lawyers turn them loose, and I'm having a hard time explaining this one just on the basic common sense thing, and just help me.
Can you help Representative Stoltz? Ms. Wilson.
Lieutenant Chair, Representative Stoltz, I'm not sure. I'm sorry if I shock you with my comment. I certainly don't intend to. The concerns is there. I guess I don't know how to say this. You have a probation or parole officer involved because they are the one supervising them. And if you, I mean, you take one extreme. If you were to take another, a person who has driven with their license suspended. So then if a police officer sees them in a parking lot with anywhere near a vehicle, does that mean it's okay to detain them and maybe arrest them because they could be violating a condition? There's examples that you can give on both ends of the range. And sometimes it is a hassle to live within our Constitution. It interferes sometimes with things we might want to do, but I don't think we really want to go to that place where we don't abide by our Constitution. So I don't know that I can answer your question. But
well, I appreciate the civil liberties primer.
Okay, thank you, Representative Stoltz. Seeing no other questions for you, Ms. Wilson, thank you for staying online with us. Hopefully you can join us again tomorrow.
I actually would like to on the amendment.
Great. Okay. Let's see. I have also Lieutenant Alan Story. I don't know if you were just for questions or did you want to testify, sir? A
couple of comments I'd like to offer.
Okay. Please do.
Actually, my name is Al Story. I'm a captain with the state troopers working on the director's staff here at our headquarters. I wanted to speak directly to Sections 26, 30, and 31. We support those concepts. I think most citizens of Alaska believe that police already have those abilities, and as was alluded to earlier, are surprised when they find out that we don't have capabilities of working with probation and parole officers to make sure that their clients are abiding by the conditions of their release. Obviously, the benefits to the person themselves is to encourage them to abide by the program and rehabilitate themselves. I don't know that some of the concerns that are being voiced are realistic. Quite frankly, The police are out there in many locations 24 hours a day. We frequently know who's in the community and what their history is, and they'll recognize when they're wandering from the path and are able to take action so that they're held accountable for their behavior, up to and maybe helping them with their rehabilitation processes, but certainly providing that public safety margin, has been alluded to in some of the scenarios that were provided to make sure that our most serious offenders are not out there maybe being a perpetrator again. Certainly in the remote areas of the state, it's not uncommon for a trooper to go to a village and recognize somebody that he knows is on probation or parole to be intoxicated. Maybe that's one of their conditions of release. That's certainly not consistent with the whole parole and probation program, and our trooper, with the passage of this, will have some ability to deal with that and take action to make the community safe and to ensure that that person is less willing to violate that again, because he knows the trooper might show up someday and see him, whereas the ability of parole and probation officers to get to those villages frequently is limited. And I also might point out that we spend a lot of time training police and probation officers on search and seizure issues, and quite frankly, many times they're more knowledgeable about those issues and better at applying those standards than others involved in the system. So to say that they should be limited circumstances that they can apply that, I think in some ways common sense. But again, most people think we can already do that. We think that we can do it well, that we do have ongoing relationship with parole and probation officers, and we'd like to enhance that under the provisions of Sections 26, 30, and 31. I could answer any questions if there were any.
Okay. Thank you, Lieutenant Story. Yes, we do have a question. Representative Hawker.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just an editorial comment, perhaps, but on the captain's presentation, I'm not a lawyer, I'm an accountant. This presentation here just made the most sense to me of anything I've heard all day.
Yes, you did a good job. Is it lieutenant or captain? I'm sorry.
It's captain this year. Last year it was lieutenant.
Okay, I'm sorry. My apologies. Yes, thank you for your testimony. It's good common sense testimony. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Let's see, was there anyone else online that wanted to testify? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else here in the audience? I do want to give the sponsor an opportunity to kind of wrap up some of the comments we've heard today. Seeing no one else in the audience, then Representative Samuels, if you can kind of wrap things up.
Sure.
You've heard a lot of comments today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief, and I'm also not a lawyer, so I'll be extremely brief.
You're not apologizing, right?
I'm not apologizing. First, to the fiscal note, 90% of the cases that get into the system get dealt, and the defense bar, whether it be a private defender or a public defender, and the prosecutors, they can make a deal on which classification. Maybe you say if you plead guilty, we'll give you a Class B instead of a Class A, or you make a deal on the sentence, or that's the way that the system works, it gets dealt. Very few actually go to trial. So just so you keep that in mind, and the fiscal implications of this, it's causing a huge uproar because that number is now causing this huge turmoil. But fiscally, I'm dealing with a lot of cases. The second point I'd like to make is that in all of the discussions here, we're not talking about the rights of the accused. We're talking about the rights of the convicted. And to me, there's a huge difference between somebody always trying to protect the rights and make sure that somebody has their fair shake. This person's already been convicted of the crime, and that's the debate on the entire bill. Thirdly, and right along with that, when a sentence gets mitigated, a judge can go to half of the, right now, the presumptive sentence is 8 years for a crime. You can mitigate for the factors that are, I believe, listed in the bill. And you can go to half of that sentence. The victims have no right to appeal that. That's the way it goes. And no jury trial, there's no... So if you're trying to balance the two sides, if you will. And the last one was a comment that I believe the public defender made. The example that she gave for the range, which goes to a 10-year range from 30 to 40 years, it's 30 presumptive sentence now, and the range would go to 30 to 40. I just wanted to clarify for the committee, that is for an unclassified sex offense with two prior sex felonies. That is a third time pedophile or a third time rapist convicted the third time. So the 30's too low, the 40's too low. I don't buy that argument on that particular example. I understand the concerns on, I think the ranges are pretty realistic and pretty narrow, and I understand her point of view or not. That's a bad example. That one ought to be 99. And an amendment to doing that would, speaking for myself, would be more than welcome, because third time felony sex offense, how many of the kids are out there that got sodomized or molested? So, that being what it is, I know there's some amendments tomorrow dealing with the concerns on the appellate process.
Okay.
There are a couple others, I believe, that will try to get to you as soon as we can. With that, I appreciate your time.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Sames. Any questions for the sponsor? Representative Sames, hold on a second. Representative Kelly?
No, I didn't have a question. I was just going to make a comment that, since it's fresh in my mind, it seems to me that it would be very demeaning to a police officer, and they would quickly lose interest if they saw the situation that was earlier described, the person in the bar, told not to go there. They've got to go see a parole officer, get permission to do something. What it means is that's over with. They're not going to do it. They've lost the opportunity. And I think it's demeaning to say that the trooper or the police officer who's following that doesn't have the good judgment that the parole officer might. I disagree with both of those.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Okay, well, I think we'll conclude the comments. The public testimony is closed. At this point in time, it's already 3:20. The chair will entertain any amendments, if you could get them to Suzanne, is that correct? Suzanne, and then Suzanne will get them to all of us as quickly as possible, so we have a chance to review them, digest them, and look at them before our meeting tomorrow. So that's the plan. We'll come back tomorrow. We'll take up this bill with any amendments and final comments. Nothing else to come before us?
We're adjourned.
Good to meet you. Yes, sir.
I may play with that idea of...
This is not
appealing immediately.